My guest is Steve Erlanger. Steve Erlanger is the chief diplomatic correspondent in Europe of the New York Times. And welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Thank you, Paul. Lovely to be with you.
Welcome back, actually, because we had a chat actually about 3 years ago, I think, when COVID was still ravaging Europe. And it's great to have you back. We're obviously going to talk about the Trump election victory now a month ago, just exactly a month ago. Before we drill down into too much detail, let's first of all go big picture stuff. Did you, with the benefit of hindsight or without the benefit of hindsight, did you see his victory coming?
I wouldn't say I saw it coming, but I saw it certainly as possible.
Right.
I mean, the polls were incredibly close. I think Kamala Harris ran a pretty good campaign, but from a very late start. I think the Democrats have been in power quite a long time. This would have been yet another Democratic administration. And I think given the economy, which is what everybody votes on, really, they don't really care about, you know, European politics very much in America. I thought it was very risky. She could have won with Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. So I was paying my attention only to those three states.
Right.
In the end, she lost them all, but she lost all of them by a total of 250,000 votes, which in America is not a big margin.
No,
so
no.
It was a closer in the Electoral College than it looked, right?
Okay.
But once she lost those three, it was over. And in terms of the popular vote, I was a little surprised. Actually, Trump beat her in the popular vote, though only by a tiny margin, but because it was very close. But for the Republicans to win the popular vote after Biden had won the popular vote by 6 million votes,
yeah,
right, was gave you an idea that people were not happy. So I wasn't shocked, but I didn't predict it per se, no.
It is a kind of confusing picture because there's a narrative even now, a month on, that Trump scored this stunning victory, you know, quote unquote. And yet, as you just said, it wasn't that huge a margin. Having said that, is it big enough of a defeat for the Democrats for them to finally have a quite profound soul searching about, what they're at, what kind of election platform they should have the next time around? Or will they slip into a kind of complacency by saying, well, it wasn't such a huge victory after all for Trump?
No, I think there will be serious look at where the party is. Partly it's a generational look. It's time, right, to have a different generation. I mean, it's kind of absurd to have these two old people running, you know, Trump, Biden, I meant.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of very intelligent, smart, well-respected Democrats. And, you know, we can go through some of them, but I think the big debate, and we'll find out more as they dig deeper and deeper and deeper into the vote results, but there's a sense that the Democrats need to restore faith with the white working class. That's the first thing. And they need to revitalize their connections to Black men in particular.
Right.
Who did not vote for Kamala Harris, now whether it was because of her, because of racism, because she was Jamaican and Indian, I have no idea, but people will figure this out. And then there's just this feeling that wokeism is fading a bit and that the Democratic Party kind of
indulged in that, maybe, yeah.
I mean, it's basically been a bicoastal party with big cities in the middle.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, crazy to see why they became so interested in identity politics and feminist politics and so on. But I think that had very little to say to the white working class people that Biden attracted last time and that she did not attract this time. So I think there really will be some rethinking.
In terms of turnout, is there data coming through a month on to show us to what extent white male, working class males, went out to vote, how much young black men went out to vote, how much the Hispanic, Latino community population went out to vote?
We're beginning to understand that. I mean, you know, at first you do it on the basis of exit polls, but now you can do it on the basis of actual real voting.
Right.
And what happened is a lot of minorities, particularly Black minorities in the big cities who came out for Biden, did not come out for Kamala Harris, not in the numbers she needed, right? And a lot of this, if you remember, Obama lectured black men, that they should embrace their sister, but many of them decided not to. And then to me, one of the most interesting results is among Latinos who obviously are doing well in America and have their own economic interests at heart and are becoming a bit more conservative as a group. And quite a lot of them voted for Trump. And it's not just because of Cuba policy, right? It's because of taxes and so on. And inflation. I mean, people were really hurt. I mean, I'm back in the US for a visit, and you're very struck by inflation. I mean, it's there and it undermines everything, even if the economy in America is doing very well compared to Europe. So I think those are the biggest things. I mean, the white working class who didn't go to college, this was always Trump's base. When you add, and they came out, but when you add some Latinos and the lack of turnout by some of the groups the Democrats are really depending on, you have this very narrow loss.
Put me straight on something. Let's talk about Trump now and his victory. I'm generally confused. I'm trying to work out whether in the past this was the case as well. But it seems like Trump became president, ten weeks, 2 months or so before the actual inauguration. In terms of people talking about some of the policies he's going to implement, tariffs obviously spring to mind, but also the names for his administration, top jobs. It seems like everybody's already talking about this kind of stuff, even though we're quite a while away from the Democrats. You would never guess that, but the Democrats are still in the White House, right? Biden is still the president. The front pages are dominated by what tariffs and other stuff, and also about all these top jobs. We'll come to the details, some of the nomination in a second. But was it always like that, or am I right in saying it's a bit different this time around?
It is a bit different, partly because, and there's just a sense of a dying regime, which is an odd kind of feeling. I think in France you have much the same feeling, right?
Well, as of yesterday,
Yeah, so that you know, and all the press in Washington want to do is talk to the Trump people, because they've talked enough to the Biden people. Now, on foreign policy, there's still quite a lot of interest in the Middle East and in the Lebanon ceasefire and so on and so on. But partly, I think it's because two things. One, Trump is much more organized this time. His chief of staff has controlled the process fairly well in terms of who would get named, and did things quite quickly. If you remember the first term, the first Trump term, he was shocked to win. He didn't expect to win. And so he wasn't ready. And he kept nominating all these people he met in the airport lounge who impressed him, right? I mean, this time there was a lot more thinking, though many of the people, he's nominated are a bit two finger to the establishment people, and who are people who either were really good on Fox television and impressed him that way, or who were loyalists to him. But it is more than usual. In a way, in some ways, it's impolite, but in a way, it's also there's so much confusion about actually what Trump wants to do that there's enormous interest in trying to figure out that from who he's nominating. Though there's a lot of contradictions in policy among the people that he's nominating. So
Let me
there's
push
a
you on
lot of
that one.
confusion.
That on that kind of the confusions in policy, but also in the these nominees' profiles, right? So we the whole world, but certainly here in Europe, we're trying to work out, is each nomination a good thing or a bad thing? And there are all these wild cases. We'll come to a couple of second, which haven't clearly not survived. Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, right? Is it? And then Pete Hegseth, who may not survive as the nominee for defense. But then people say on some of the economic portfolios and even the foreign affairs portfolios, he's chosen quote unquote more sensible, more mainstream Republicans or people who aren't particularly linked to politics historically. Well, how do you feel when you kind of look at the broad sweep of the administration?
Trump likes to watch people debate their policies in front of him and gets to decide. I mean, George Bush used to call himself the decider. But Trump really likes to have people fighting for his favor, fighting for his attention, and arguing about policies, which is, actually, I think one of the things about Trump I rather like. I mean, he's willing to listen to different points of view. So I think it's actually a relatively diverse group of people, particularly on foreign policy terms. As you say, to have Marco Rubio as Secretary of State from the Senate, that'll get confirmed easily. Classic, but at the same time, very strong against Cuba, had been very pro-Ukraine, but has softened a bit because of Trump. He named his, special envoy for Ukraine a general named Keith Kellogg, who's like 80 something, who again has been big on Fox, but who has again been quite strong about Ukraine, but has written pay, so there's going to be a debate. And yet you have J.D. Vance, his vice president, who in some ways Trump may see as his inheritor, at least for now, who says, we've given enough money to Ukraine. It's not our problem. Let the Europeans deal with it. No more money, right? And that's what his son says, Donald Trump Jr. says, enough money. So you'll have these debates. Even on China, you have people who think, that's all we need to worry about, just China, people like Elbridge Colby. And then you have people who say, let's go to economic war with China and to hell with the consequences. And you have some people say, Taiwan's no more our big national interest than Ukraine is. So these debates will take a while to figure out. It's confusing, but I think it's meant to be confusing.
Well, it is confusing as well, but again, the Trump is so unpredictable. You never know whether it's part of a plan or just the way he is. He can't help himself because clearly some of these well, a couple of people like I mentioned, Matt Gaetz, he's already withdrawn from the process, right? So clearly, it's not going to be walk in the park, even with a Republican majority in the Senate, to get some of these nominations approved, no?
I agree with that. I mean, there are four or five Republican senators who are skeptical, and I think they will want him to get the people he wants, but they will not swallow people who, have been accused of things that they shouldn't, that should disqualify them for office. Thinking of Hegseth, for instance, at defense. Now, Hegseth says he's going to push through, but my guess is he'll be a sacrifice just as Gates was. And maybe they're a sacrifice to get other people through. I mean, the big question, to me, as American, I worry more about the war at home than foreign policy. So I'm paying a lot of attention to what happens at the Department of Justice and who's the Attorney General and is he going to fire the FBI director and name his own person and are they going to live up to their threats for retribution against certain Democrats and prosecutors? This sort of thing is very important to watch. And will the Senate, as you suggested, have the backbone to resist Trump's efforts to avoid FBI investigation of candidates? I mean, will the Senate exercise its constitutional obligation for advice and consent on key positions? These are things we have to see, but I think it will tell us quite a lot about how much Trump thinks he can get done just by force of will. That's where these cabinet positions make a big difference, I think.
The so-called Trump effect. I'm not sure whether you go along with it, but I'll ask you in a second, whereby all of a sudden, obviously more in the foreign relations field, I'm thinking obviously in the Middle East and also Ukraine and Russia, the kind of tectonic plates have shifted and people are now more than hitherto willing to come to the negotiating table, whatever, because they see there's a whole new world now with Trump in the White House, what they call maybe rashly the Trump effect. Do you give any credence to that thesis?
Well, I do to some degree, just because Trump has been very open about certain obsessions of his, right? One is he loves tariffs. Two is he's obsessed with balance of trade. He thinks the only good balance of trade is zero. You know, he's not an economist, but these are old beliefs. He wants Europe to spend more on defense. He's believed that for 40 years, as other Americans have done. He is skeptical about putting more and more money in Ukraine. He also is, and this to me is interesting and has an effect, he has been reluctant to get into wars. I think he wants to end what he considers to be Biden's wars, even if Biden didn't start them, in Ukraine and in the Middle East. I don't think he cares whose interests are harmed by stopping these wars, but I think he's very eager to stop them and take credit for stopping the bloodshed. And so he is accelerating a debate on Ukraine that I think needs to happen anyway. And the other thing, sometimes I think October 7th, when Hamas went into Israel, it's been a bit like 9/11. It has really shaken up the world, certainly in the Middle East. It's changé les donnes, as the French would say, partly because it has affected Lebanon. It's pretty much destroyed Hamas. It's pretty much destroyed Hezbollah. It's weakened Iran. You see in Syria, opposition groups moving to respond to this perceived weakness. So the wheels are spinning, and they're not because of Trump necessarily, but they're accelerated by Trump. And so I think it's sometimes I think it's a year a bit like 1989, where suddenly something happened we didn't expect. The wall fell, and then things started to move. And that's a little bit the way it feels to me.
As a sidebar on that, Steve, am I right in saying that the incoming National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, has said, I think on the record, that I've been consulting widely in the run-up to my new position with the current NSA guy, Jake Sullivan, and we are basically on the same page, and people shouldn't try either to look for any differences between the two of us, or even try to more seriously exploit any differences between the two of us, because there aren't any real differences of view when it comes views when it comes to the NSA brief. Have you seen that?
Well, I've seen it. I don't really believe it.
All
I
right.
believe that he is urging people to respect that there's one president at a time and don't take advantage of this interim. I think
Right.
that's aimed at Moscow
Right.
as much as anywhere else, because you see in Ukraine, in the interim, both sides trying to get their troops as far in their right direction as possible. Understanding that there's likely to be some kind of ceasefire at some point, and some sort of talks. Now, whether, and Trump can push that, he says that he's going to. Now, whether that would result in a settlement or not, we have no idea, because it's still not clear to me that Putin wants any sort of deal that says stop. I do think Waltz is saying the right things, and in the Middle East, especially. You know, he is trying to support the Biden administration's efforts to get the hostages out of Gaza, to get Lebanon quiet. I think they'd like to come into office with some of these things resolved. You saw Trump the other day threatening Hamas with even more hell if they didn't release the hostages. I'm not sure how much more hell he can threaten them with than what they've already gotten, but I think in January he'd like to begin with something closer to a clean slate.
You mentioned briefly NATO. Does Trump or his entourage, more precisely, have a game plan, a strategy for dealing with NATO in the as of next January? Apart from haranguing Europeans for not paying enough into the budget, I see that he's has nominated his ambassador to NATO, not to the European Union, as far as I'm aware. So, in that is that in itself significant?
I think, again, it's a debate. Trump has these basic views that he's had since 1980s, that American allies take advantage of us. We provide their security. That means they can build these wonderful social welfare systems. And, you know, they're richer than we are, and they should pay more. And I think that's still true. It's also true, you know, next to Europe is a war, like a real war,
On our doorstep,
yeah, with a bear, rampaging through the fields right next to NATO. So that should be a prise de conscience. That should be a wake-up call. And I think it frustrates a lot of Americans that it hasn't been a sufficient wake-up call. Now, Mark Rutte, the new head of NATO, is something of a Trump whisperer and has been arguing quite correctly, even before the election, that Europe needs to spend more. It should spend more like 2.5 or 3% of GDP on defense, but in a coordinated way, which is the important point. And it should work to develop some of the strategic enablers that only the Americans provide, because Trump aside, America's interests in the Middle East and in Asia that mean it has less time and money to spend on Europe. And that's just common sense. Macron's been arguing that forever. It's simply true. It's true whether Trump's the president or Kamala Harris is the president. So I think the warnings have been there. It's not like NATO's done nothing. That's really unfair. I mean, particularly since 2022 and the invasion, the actual they didn't do much between 2014 and 2022, but you know, there have been a lot more NATO troops put along all the border countries with Russia. There's been increased spending, been more ammunition production. It's been slower than people would like. But Europe has given quite a lot to Ukraine. But the question Trump creates, the argument he accelerates, is where is this war headed? I mean, because there may be a plan for Ukraine, but there's not a strategy. I mean, there's no strategy that produces the Ukraine that the Ukrainians insist upon, and there isn't enough stuff to give them. The war is not going in their direction. So the big question is, how do you bring it to a conclusion before all of Ukraine's infrastructure is destroyed and it runs out of manpower? And what, if you can create this ceasefire, how do you protect Ukraine down the road? Now, I don't think Trump is that interested. I can see Trump saying, okay, I've got a ceasefire now. Now, you Europeans, you take care of Ukraine, right? Because they're
I've
not
done the
getting into
deal-yo
NATO,
mindset. Yeah, yeah,
right? So, in that sense, I do think Trump accelerates certain things that needed to happen. Anyway, I don't think he's going to pull out of NATO, by the way. I don't think he's going to withdraw the American nuclear umbrella. I mean, certainly his top foreign policy people are not in favor of that. And I think quite a lot of it's bargaining. If Europe just pays more, does more, I think one can satisfy him. For example, there's all this discussion now of if you get a ceasefire in Ukraine, that maybe European troops would move into Ukraine
as a
to
kind of
help hold
police
the
force,
ground. Well, you know, that would be very tempting for Vladimir Putin to test the will of
the
NATO
Europeans,
member countries, even if not NATO itself, and would Trump come to their aid or not? And how would they do it without American air cover and without American intel and so on? So, I mean, a lot of ideas floating around. Most of them are half-baked, it seems to me.
Well, one final question, Steve. And it may seem rather parochial to you, but indulge me, please, which is this idea that we've seen in the past 2, 3 weeks personalities like Kim Darroch, former UK ambassador to the United States, as you know, Pascal Lamy, former head of WTO and European Trade Commissioner, and others, that's plus the commentariat, saying this is the moment now for the UK, hence the parochial quote, to work out which side it's on. I'm obviously simplifying grotesquely here, but UK has to choose now. Now that it's now or never, which camp are you in? Are these interventions well timed? Do they have substance behind them? Or will the UK always be incapable of actually choosing? They'll always try and have their cake and eat it, basically.
Well, I think this is, again, accelerating a debate that needs to happen in Britain anyway, and something Prime Minister has already opened, which is we need to have better relations with Brussels. We need to have better relations with the EU that are not simply on the basis of security. I don't see, like, urgency to it. But I think it needs to happen. It's headed in the right direction. You have a new commission, you have a new government in Britain, and you have in Trump someone who's actually very pro-British. You know, he is. He loves Britain. You just invite him again to meet King Charles. If King Charles can hold his nose long enough, Trump will be a very happy man, right? He doesn't feel the same way about Germany. But this dream of this, you know, new free trade agreement somehow between the UK and the US that goes around the EU, I think it's just complicated. UK has been very slow actually to break trade ties with the EU in terms of goods coming in and out and tariffs and so on. And I think that's been very wise. And the problem with a US-UK deal is it may put at risk those understandings with the European Union. So I think it has to be done very carefully. But I think there's a lot of goodwill everywhere now for a better relationship. And I don't think it's a do or die moment, but I think it's a good moment for a debate in Britain that needs to happen and which is happening because it can't be done without popular will.
Well, we'll develop that discussion a bit more next time we get to do another podcast together. Steve Erlanger, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul.